From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The nation's largest retailer, Walmart, announced today that all shoppers will be required to wear face masks starting next week. The policy shift comes as the U.S. reports another single-day record of new COVID-19 cases yesterday, more than 67,000.
One of the states seeing a spike is Louisiana, where the governor shut bars back down this week. The Trump administration chose the city of Baton Rouge as one of several places for an experiment in surge testing. We're joined now by Baton Rouge Mayor Sharon Weston Broome. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And I want to ask you about this experiment the federal government is running. They're providing surge testing in a few cities around the country, including Baton Rouge, testing anyone for free. It's been going on for about a week. How is it working there so far?
Well, so far, our surge testing, we've tested 16,825 individuals since last Tuesday. So we have more than doubled our daily testing capacity.
And are they getting their results quickly?
Well, the results are scheduled between 3 to 5 days, and it's my understanding that individuals have been receiving the results according to that timeline.
Would you say to other cities, because you are one of the test cities, that this is a good model that should be expanded around the country, to have the federal government come in and help with the testing in this way?
It certainly is an excellent model of testing. First of all, tests are being distributed throughout the city. So we have tests in disinvested areas of the community. So the access to the test. Secondly, the tests are free. And thirdly, if you have symptoms or you don't have symptoms and you just want to know your status, you can. And so these testing sites throughout our region certainly are improving our capacity for testing. And we definitely know that testing is part of the equation for mitigating COVID-19.
Give us a sense of the overall situation in Baton Rouge right now, because you are one of the places that saw early spikes, then things got better, and now they're starting to get worse again.
Yeah, unfortunately, new daily cases in East Baton Rouge Parish have quadrupled in the last month. And hospitalizations in our region have increased 145% just in the last week. So unfortunately, we are practically back to where we were a few months ago.
And why do you think that is?
I think people got relaxed. I think we had some holidays where people made themselves a part of crowds. Here in Baton Rouge, we had young people who were part of big crowds at bars in the many of the people in there have tested positive. I did a mask mandate almost going on 3 weeks ago, well, 2 weeks now. I know that has helped based on our observations. And then our governor just rolled out a statewide mandate. And so we understand while masks are not the final frontier, masks and face coverings are certainly a part of the mitigation process.
Are you in favor of doing another shutdown, doing another stay-at-home order? Should the governor do that at this point?
I will tell you, we make our decisions based on data and research and science, but I will tell you, Jeremy, I do not want to see us go back. As you know, a shutdown has enormous impact. So I just would like for people to move more intensely towards compliance so we can mitigate this.
Let me ask you just one more thing before I let you go. There's a video that shows a Baton Rouge police officer putting his knee on a black teenager who is lying on the ground. The teen was a passenger who had been in a 54-minute car chase with police. Now, it's not clear exactly whether the officer's knee is on the neck or on the back of the teenager. The police department is investigating. What would you say to the residents of Baton Rouge right now?
Well, first of all, a knee on the neck of any citizen as a tactic for restraint is unacceptable here in the city and parish of Baton Rouge. This is not new to us. As you know, in 2016, we had the killing of Alton Sterling, an officer-involved shooting. Mm-hmm. So we have been a community in trauma. We have made progress. I don't want us to regress. There is a timely investigation that is going on, and I will assure that equity and justice is always the standard.
Do you think, based on what you've seen, that the officer's knee is on the neck or the back of the teen?
Let me just say this. The optics do not look good. And I'm not going to debate the optics, but I'm going to say what the standard here is in Baton Rouge. An officer putting a knee on the neck of any citizen as a tactic will not be tolerated.
That is the mayor of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Sharon Weston Broom. Mayor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Starting today, the Trump administration is telling hospitals and laboratories to bypass the Center for Disease Control and Prevention when reporting data about the coronavirus. And some public health officials are saying this change will make it harder to track and respond to the pandemic. Let's bring in Dr. Jewel Mullen, epidemiologist at the University of Texas, Austin, and former principal deputy assistant secretary for health in the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Mullen, welcome back.
Thank you.
So starting today, the Trump administration says that, quote, hospitals should no longer report the COVID-19 information to the National Healthcare Safety Network site. That's the CDC's database for coronavirus data, and instead report it to Teletracking. That's a federal contractor for the Department of Health and Human Services, or to their state, which would coordinate the federal reporting. How significant is this change?
It's going to take time to know just how significant the change is, but I'll tell you why I was concerned when I first read about this and why I continue to be concerned. Hearing about this shift away from sending data to CDC feels to me like another step in eroding the ability of our nation's primary agency responsible for protecting the health and safety of all of us. Seems like a step backward and makes me concerned.
The HHS is saying that this will streamline reporting and reduce duplication of the data. What's your response to that? Could this actually be an improvement?
Streamlined is a nice word. In this case, the guidance states that hospitals can get a waiver from their state health agencies so that they can continue to report within the state rather than to the White House. I'm not quite sure how that's going to streamline a process. And I don't know enough about the firm that's been hired to do this work to really know how efficient, how effective, how transparent it is, and how readily the data will actually get into the hands of the people who need to use it.
Democrats have accused the White House of trying to politicize this collection of data that's crucial to any public health response to the pandemic. Yesterday, four former CDC directors wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post accusing the White House of undermining the CDC and subverting scientific expertise. Is that how you see it?
What I'm seeing right now is evidence on a daily basis that we can't feel like we are winning the response to this pandemic. When it comes to concerns about politicizing the issue, I'm concerned that we're losing what needs to be a big fight to help people understand that public health ought not be politicized.
To this point that you're making, an HHS spokesman told the New York Times that the CDC would continue to make data public and that hospitals could continue reporting this data to states who could also make it public. Is that enough assurance in your view that this data isn't being suppressed or politicized?
I read in one report that a government official had pledged to make the data public. I would like to see the pledge for all of us to be convinced. Then I would be able to answer your question. And like anything else, to follow that pledge with the actions that follow the words. Until then, we should minimally remain hopeful that things will roll out the way they are pledged to occur, and maximally remain very vigilant that we are losing even more ability to know the truth about what's happening right now.
One last question for you. There are reports that the Trump administration is asking governors to consider sending the National Guard to hospitals to help improve in data collection. What do you think of this proposal?
Every day I hear a new idea of something that might be another patch to a system that doesn't exist, a coordinated federal response to the pandemic. I get concerned that we're moving farther and farther away from that. We ought not need to call in some troops to do that if we actually stand up the people in our government who have committed to serve the public to actually do their jobs.
That's Dr. Jewel Mullen, epidemiologist at the University of Texas, Austin, and the former principal deputy assistant secretary for health in the Department of Health and Human Services. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
A little more than a week ago, I had what I can only describe as a mindset shift. I'm dealing with the same uncertainty everyone else is. When will this pandemic be over? How much worse will it get? Can I make any plans in the next few months or even the next year? When will I stop working from home and go back to the office? Then I thought to myself, I can't really control any of that. I can do my part, wear a mask in public, social distance, but what if rather than fighting that uncertainty and getting anxious about it, I just accepted it, even leaned into it? That idea is something Gretchen Rubin has been thinking about as well. She's author of The Happiness Project, Happier at Home and Better Than Before, among others, and host of the podcast Happier with Gretchen Rubin. She joins us now. Gretchen, welcome to Here and Now.
I'm so happy to be talking to you.
I'm happy to be talking to you as well. And I want to say at the outset here that, of course, there are people who have lost loved ones because of the coronavirus. There are people who've gotten very sick. There are people who've lost their jobs. And that is obviously much worse than any uncertainty that the rest of us are feeling. But do you find that you're thinking about the coronavirus pandemic in a different way now than you were at the beginning?
You know, it really has changed because at the beginning there was just the shock of the new, and it was sort of everybody was running around and it was all about the toilet paper. And now I think we're really settling into this different state, as you said, where we realize it's going to be uncertain for a long time and that we don't really know what the horizon is, and things might move forward and they might move backward. And things that seemed impossibly far in the future, like, oh, September, school going back, it seemed like, oh, well, we'll worry about that later. Well, now that's all coming real. And so I think people's feelings are changing.
So what do you do about that? How do you better sort of accept that situation?
Well, it's really hard because, you know, this uncertainty is hard. People keep saying to me, if I had a date, we'll all know by November 15th or something, and you could sort of pace yourself to a deadline or, you know, a finish line. But we don't know. And so one of the things that I'm really doing is trying to understand, like, well, there is so much uncertainty, there's loss, but what am I learning? What am I gaining? What insights am I having? Some things are working worse, but some things are working better. And can I gain from that? One thing I've heard a lot of people talk about is, well, I'm cooking more and I'm eating healthfully because I'm not commuting. I have more time. And so one of the things is to think to yourself, okay, well, one day everything is going to go back. Let me acknowledge the gains that I have. This is the silver lining. And how might I think about what I need to change in the future that's going to help me hold on to this? Because if I feel like I'm learning something useful out of this time, I'll be comforted by that.
You know, I've also thought about travel because it's something that I love to do. And it's something in the past I was able to do. And right now it's obviously very difficult to do it and can even be dangerous. But I thought, well, what if instead of taking a trip somewhere, I decided I'm working from home. Why don't I just go work from home somewhere else for a month or two, and just we'll all just move somewhere else for a couple of months, not knowing, you know, when this will be over.
Well, it's funny because I think it took a while to kind of wrap our minds around the idea that, like, we could be anywhere, you know, because this idea of being freed from having to show up. And I think for a lot of people, to travel also is a relief because maybe they were traveling a lot from work and now they're not doing that. So that's opening up other time. One thing, if you love to travel and you're frustrated because you're not able to travel, one thing you can do is be a tourist in your own hometown. Now, you may not be able to go to a museum, but, you know, maybe there's a national park or just like a local park that you've never visited. A lot of times there's things that we ignore just because they're in our own backyard. You know, even if you're going to go for your walk, go to a different neighborhood and explore it and get that sense of something new and novel and really learn more about where you are and take advantage of this time.
I've seen other advice to not be too ambitious. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. Don't feel like you have to use this time to get in great shape or learn another language or lose weight or whatever. What's your thinking on that?
Well, you know, I think there's a real tension there because I think on the one hand, we absolutely want to show ourselves compassion. This is a global pandemic. We've never gone through this. So you want to be kind to yourself. On the other hand, everything has consequences. And so I think sometimes people are like, well, nothing counts. Well, unfortunately, everything does count. And so you don't want to come out of this period feeling worse because of having decided that this doesn't count. So I think we want to remember that. But I do think some people are sort of like, well, if I'm not going to do it now, when am I going to do it? This is the time. Like, how is it possible that I haven't cleaned every closet or got deep into meditation or learned Italian or whatever it is? So I do think we need to be realistic. But it's also true that one of the ways that we can feel better about what's going through is if we do feel like we've made good use of the time. And if you feel like, wow, I was safer at home, and so I did organize my basement, or I did update my resume, or I did take that online course, or I did learn how to use that new software, that will make us feel better going forward because it's something good that came from this. We were able to make good use of it. And that's comforting because there's so much we can't do. But again, it's with the idea that it may not be a productive time for you. You may have so much uncertainty and so much chaos in like how your household is running or what you're up against. I think each of us has to decide for ourselves, like, am I going to ask more of myself or am I going to cut myself some slack?
You recommend scheduling time to worry. Tell me how that would work exactly.
Yeah. So this is, you know, for many people, just constant rumination is very draining. And like all day long, you're sort of revisiting questions and worrying. So when you schedule time to worry, you just, and don't schedule your time to worry right before bedtime, but maybe you say at 11 a.m. every day or at 3 p.m. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or whatever it is, you schedule time to worry. And so you, if you find yourself worrying outside that time slot, you can say to yourself, it's not time to worry about that now, but I'm not ignoring it. I'm not trying to push it aside. I'm going to address my worry when the time comes. So what that does is it frees up your other time. You don't have to worry. You're not constantly ruminating and being dragged down by these circling thoughts in other parts of your day. Then when you sit down to worry, you can like sit down, have pen and paper or whatever you want, and really think through, well, what am I worried about? And a lot of times when we really address our worries in kind of a systematic way, they seem more manageable. And also, like if you wake up in the middle of the night with racing thoughts, which many people do, if you write it down then and you think, okay, this is what's on my mind, and then I will worry about it when the time comes, then your mind can release it and then it's much easier to go back to sleep. One thing that I'm facing, and I think a lot of people are facing, is that sort of what we're supposed to do or what is best practices changes. And I think for some people that becomes very decision fatigue, like, should I do this? Should I do that? Do I need to be doing this? Am I wasting my time by doing this? Or am I being completely irresponsible by not doing that? So one way to schedule time to worry is say, okay, periodically I'm going to check in and I'm really going to do my research and I'm going to see like what is the best advice right now, the experts that I respect, and what are they saying about, can I do this? Is this safe? And I'm going to follow that advice. And I'm not going to rethink it or question it until it's the next periodic check-in time. By periodically checking in, you assure yourself, knowing what I know now, I'm doing the best thing that I can, and I'll update that when the time is right.
I mentioned at the top that we don't have control over the big picture. We can do certain things to slow the spread and stop the spread of the virus as individuals. But for those that do have more control over the big picture, people in Washington, D.C., does the fact that there's an election coming up in a few months add to the anxiety that we're all feeling right now?
Well, I think it adds to it tremendously because I think people feel that there is so much uncertainty and the stakes are so high. I mean, one of the things that surprised me, I never thought of myself as being a particularly future-oriented person, I mean, more than the average person, but you realize how much we do live in the future and how much we do think, well, in the fall, this will happen, and after the election, this will happen, but we don't know. And that's just very wearing on people.
So, for our listeners who are hearing you say this, what would your one piece of advice to them be of how to kind of handle this uncertainty, handle their anxiety a little bit better, and maybe even, as we said, lean in and make the most of the situation?
Well, if you're going to think about happiness, the key to happiness is strong relationships, if you had to pick one thing. So as you're going through this time, really pay attention to your relationships, staying connected with other people, going out on the street and smiling at people, your neighbors over the masks, looking for ways to feel connected to other people. And also, you know, to do good in the world, to feel connected to your larger community, because maybe you can't control the virus, but you could do virtual volunteering or you could do virtual babysitting for somebody who's got little kids at home and can't get any work done. If we do good, we feel good. And that will make us feel closer to the people in our lives and closer to our community. And so that is something that's within our control that will really, you know, boost our spirits in a tough time.
When do you think this will be over, Gretchen?
Well, I have no idea. no, you know, I keep thinking of the line from the Roman poet Ovid when he says, "Be patient and tough. One day this pain will be useful to you." I think we all just have to, like, hang in there and hope that one day this pain will be useful. In whatever way, we'll get through it.
I mean, this too shall pass kind of seems to work every time.
And,
I'm sure it'll work here too.
And a good night's sleep. I'm a big believer in a good night's sleep. Take care of your body now more than ever. Yeah.
That is Gretchen Rubin, who is author of the books The Happiness Project, Happier at Home, and Better Than Before. She's host of the podcast Happier with Gretchen Rubin. Gretchen, thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few weeks ago, airlines were busy adding flights back to their schedules for August. For example, United Airlines added 25,000 flights to its August schedule. Now, those airlines are reversing course as the pandemic continues unabated in many parts of the country, causing airlines like Southwest and American to join United in warning that job furloughs are around the corner. For more, let's bring in Seth Kaplan here, now transportation analyst. And Seth, we remember that the airline industry got a $25 billion bailout as part of the CARES Act earlier this year. And in return, airlines had to say they were going to keep people employed till the end of September. That's coming up. What comes next for airline workers?
Nothing good for a lot of them, Jeremy. If you look at the four largest U.S. airlines, so that would be Southwest, Delta, American, and United. United, you might remember last week, already sent warnings to 36,000 workers that they could lose their jobs, although the final number could be lower. American has said it's going to be warning its workers this week, hasn't given a number, but has said it's overstaffed by tens of thousands of people for the fall. Delta and Southwest still holding out some hope of avoiding furloughs, although Southwest, if anything, has sounded more pessimistic recently. And for perspective, Jeremy, Southwest hasn't furloughed a single worker in its half-century history. So just the specter of furloughs for an airline that successful tells you how bad things are.
And what are airlines doing to their routes right now? And how many people are flying compared with the typical July?
Well, they had been trying to kind of outrun the virus. A few weeks ago, for example, JetBlue, normally a very northeastern-centric airport, especially in New York, announced some new routes from the Midwest to Florida, Cleveland to Fort Myers, for example. There was a new route from Pittsburgh to Fort Lauderdale. Well, now think about what's going on in Florida. The idea that you could just sort of adjust geographically is starting to become quaint. And I have to tell you, today, Jeremy, is the first time that I look at the passenger numbers at the TSA checkpoints and think I can see something reflecting this. About 100,000 fewer people passed through checkpoints yesterday, Tuesday of this week, than did a week earlier. 540,000 wow. Tuesday of this week compared to 2.5 million on a normal day this time of year.
Now, when it comes to the financial health of the airlines, we spoke the other day with former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, who said the federal government should spend whatever it takes to keep the airlines solvent, but that in return, the airlines should have to deal with regulations on mask wearing, on social distancing, on cleaning the planes. Do you think that a second or third, I don't know how many there have been at this point because there have been little ones along the way, but another airline bailout could be on the table?
It could be, but it's probably not going to look like the first one. Airlines did well the first time. The government had to quickly figure out how to spend $2 trillion in a matter of days, and airlines got a nice chunk of that money compared to other industries. This time, yeah, perhaps more strings and perhaps less aid. We'll see if they find it worth it to accept the aid in exchange for the strings.
I just have one more thing to ask you about because this is just such a shock, which is that airlines are trying to do everything they can to avoid looking out of touch. And in the UK, British Airways is selling its multi-million dollar art collection. What is that about?
Yeah, hanging in the airline's headquarters, also in some lounges, so at least some passengers get to see them. But hard to justify keeping that kind of art around when you're laying off people. During the global financial crisis, Germany was Alitalia, the long-troubled Italian carrier, selling off its art collection. Now a much more successful airline doing the same thing.
And we have to pay to check our bags. Seth Kaplan, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Congress returns to work next week with an urgent deadline, whether to extend the extra $600 in weekly unemployment benefits many people are relying on to survive. These benefits are set to expire next month. And state governments are also struggling to keep up with unemployment claims. Americans are experiencing long wait times and red tape trying to file for relief. One of those states is Kentucky. Matthew Glowicki is a Reader's Watchdog reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal, and he joins us now for more on what's happening there. Matthew, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
What stories are you hearing from people who are unemployed about what they're going through and what challenges they're facing there?
Sure. Lots of stories. Not a day goes by that my phone doesn't ring, my inbox doesn't at least receive a few emails from people who are worried and in some cases are desperate. But the common thing that unites them generally when they're reaching out to me is having applied weeks or maybe even months ago for benefits and not really hearing anything back.
The state of Kentucky has brought in a private service to address unemployment claims after people were protesting last month at the state capitol about not being able to file. How has that been working out?
Yes. So I'm still waiting on an update from the state about how successful things went last week. But what the state hopes is that by the end of the month, the 55,000 or so jobless claims that are backlogged from the months of March, April, and May will be cleared out. So we'll see what the end of the month brings.
Yeah, because we're talking about a backlog of 55,000 and new claims that are coming up.
Yes, that's correct. So that doesn't, again, that 55,000 or so, that's for March, April, and May. And then obviously you have the entire month of June. I think at last count, that number was somewhere in the about 20,000 claims that still needed to be processed there. You know, again, it's kind of hard to predict where the virus is heading and which establishments that have opened up might close down again. So it's unclear even for some of the folks who maybe were able to return to work if they might need to rely on the system again. So the future here, it's unclear, and I know that makes a lot of people nervous.
Absolutely. How worried are people about the CARES Act unemployment funding going away? I mean, it's set to expire at the end of the month if Congress doesn't act. We're talking about that $600 extra a week for unemployment. How concerned are your readers, and have they been vocalizing that to you?
Most definitely. I mean, I imagine this is the case in a lot of states, but that extra $600 on top of what the state is able to provide, that's for many people, that $600 is the bulk of what they've been living on. I know for many of the people I speak to, they're maybe making a few hundred in benefits. That is what has been sustaining them and their families. So to then have it reduced to, in some cases, mm-hmm. you know, as little as $100 for some people, it's I don't know how they're going to make it work.
Well, you're a Reader's Watchdog reporter, which kind of puts you in the position of talking directly with your readers. What are you hearing from people in Kentucky who are saying, hey, I'm just going to step in and try to help others who I know are out of work and they can't get their unemployment claims filled, but the need is urgent?
Indeed. I wrote about a Louisville woman. Her name is Britton Thomas, who back in April had filed for unemployment. She's a server at a restaurant here in town. And of course, with the coronavirus, in-restaurant dining was shut down. She was out of a job, filed for unemployment, and then had trouble receiving the payment. I think she ended up waiting about 5 weeks. In the meantime, she created this Facebook group trying to kind of crowdsource answers to her situation. Here we are about 3 months later, and that page has about 17,000 members from across Kentucky. That page is quite active, and there are dozens of posts every day. People just trying to share their own situations, looking for answers. Some just want to kind of commiserate. A lot of these people have been waiting in, you know, phone queues to be called back from the state, and those calls don't come for weeks and weeks. So it's a way to kind of get almost instant feedback. I think there's some comfort that people take in a group like that, hearing that they're not alone, even if that doesn't help them pay the next month's rent. It is helpful being heard, and I think that's one thing that for too many people is not happening right now.
That's Matthew Glowicki. He's a Reader's Watchdog reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal in Kentucky. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now let's go to Montgomery, Alabama, where Mia Raven is an activist there. She's been going around with wagons of free food and water and other supplies to offer to people who are unemployed. She serves as policy director for the Yellowhammer Fund, a reproductive rights organization based in Alabama. Hi, Mia.
Nice to have be here today, and thank you for having me.
Yes. So you went out earlier this month to Alabama State University, which was staffed there to offer people in-person support with filing unemployment claims after many were struggling actually to get service on the phone. And you saw hundreds of people waiting in line. Tell us more about who you saw there seeking help.
I saw a very diverse population. I saw young people, people with families. I saw people who were, in my estimation, 70 to 80 years old. And these people were lining up as early as 7 and 8 o'clock at night.
Wow. So you actually encountered people who had come the night before to get in line to have a place to receive assistance.
Correct. Because the Alabama Department of Labor would only see 300 people a day. Now, this was the only place in Alabama where they could get assistance. So if you didn't live in Montgomery, say you lived in Mobile, which is, of course, by the Gulf of Mexico, or you lived in Huntsville, which is almost to Tennessee, you still had to come to Montgomery just to get these problems fixed.
What were some of the things that folks told you as you handed out supplies to those in line?
They didn't understand why they had to come to Montgomery. And I still don't understand it myself, except for I have been working policy in Alabama for 10 years, and I have watched the Alabama legislature completely strip government services. And that's exactly what's happened here.
That in-person support has changed slightly. They've moved to another location that is appointment-based. So it seems to have improved some of the issues with waiting in line for hours. But that hasn't really soothed your worries about this unemployment crisis.
Absolutely not. Alabama has one of the lowest payouts in the entire nation. The max you can get on unemployment is $275 a week. The max amount of time you can be on unemployment is 14 weeks in Alabama. This should not have to happen to anyone, especially during a pandemic. People who were laid off in March are about to hit that wall in Alabama of 14 weeks.
How can we as fellow Americans help our friends and family that are going through this, in your opinion? I mean, you went out and physically handed out food and water to people. What else do you think others should be doing?
I know here in Alabama, we are still having shortages of basic cleaning supplies. So when I went out there at first, I just went out there, you know, food and, you know, snacks and water. And then they were like, well, do you have this? Do you have that? So we started bringing hand sanitizer, gloves, masks, the disposable mask, bleach, emergency contraception, tampons, pads. So I know every region is different, but in the Deep South, people are very proud. They won't come to you and tell you that they need something. But if you offer it to them and you offer it to them for free, they will most certainly take it. So make sure you reach out to your community and find exactly what they need. Because chances are they might not want to ask for it. But if you offer it to them, they will take it.
That's Mia Raven. She is a policy director for the Yellowhammer Fund in Alabama, and she's been helping distribute free food and other supplies to people who are unemployed. Mia, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Are you experiencing unemployment woes during this pandemic? We want to hear from you. Tell us your story at hereandnow.org.
All the theaters in New York have been closed for months, but Off-Broadway's highest honors were announced last night in a virtual presentation of the 65th annual Obie Awards. Among the winners were the musical A Strange Loop and its creative team, which includes choreographer Rajah Feather Kelly. He's been the go-to choreographer for Off-Broadway plays, including two that have won the Pulitzer Prize. As Alexandra Starr reports, Kelly has created a niche for himself, the dancer who helps playwrights tell stories.
Rajah Feather Kelly grew up in Fort Hood, Texas, where he and his sisters would dance on the front porch of their home. But he was passionate about a lot of things.
I was deciding between dance and theater a lot. Like, I started doing theater growing up, and then I switched to dance in high school. But then I also did speech and debate because I loved doing that.
Kelly launched his career at the age of 20 when he founded his own dance company, The Feather Theory. MacArthur-winning playwright Brandon Jacobs Jenkins caught one of his performances and thought he was doing something unusual.
I think a lot of movement artists, for them, movement is the kind of end-all, be-all of the aesthetic experience. But I felt that with Rajah, the movement was actually a piece of a palette, and that actually he was thinking more broadly about what movement was, what a body in motion was.
Jacobs Jenkins' plays often explore racism and identity. He saw similar strains in Kelly's performances.
There was something happening about identity that I thought was sharing territory with investigations I felt some of my colleagues in the theater were also carrying out at the time. And I think I said to him pretty early, I was like, I think you're supposed to be doing theater.
Jacobs Jenkins collaborated with Kelly on two plays and made introductions to other writers, like Jackie Sibley's Drury, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning Fairview. There isn't much dancing in that play, but movement is an important part of it. In the opening scene, an African-American family is preparing a celebratory birthday dinner. The mom is cutting up vegetables as she listens to music. And then she starts moving her hips and lip-syncing. Kelly says he wanted to bring to mind stereotypes about African-Americans that would be recognizable to anyone who's seen The Jeffersons or Black-ish.
Where you're like, oh, this is how Black people relate to each other as told by popular media. That we look at that and we're like, oh, yeah, look, she's having a good time. She's boogieing. She's doing her dance. She's living her full life. And you're like, yeah, but is she? Like, how do you know that that is what she wants to do? How do you know that that is who she is? I think we, as in a culture, have been trained to see Black women and Black men act this way.
The second half of the play forces the audience to examine those preconceptions. Kelly says he's been called in to work with playwrights who feel that what they want to express needs more than words.
And I sort of felt like a problem solver in some ways with these works. So concepts and ideas and ripping something apart and looking at all the pieces is something I am really fond of and really love to engage with.
When the work calls for more traditional choreography, Kelly will add leg kicks and finger snaps, as in the off-Broadway hit A Strange Loop. It's about a young gay Black man who aches to write his own musical.
I am a Disney usher. I'm barely scraping by. My discontentment comes in many shapes and sizes. When I wake up each morning, I tell myself to try. I tell myself that I will make no compromises.
You write musicals?
Yeah.
Awesome. Have you seen Hamilton?
Kelly says that in order to help bring out the story, he drew on his observations of the cast.
And so a lot of the movement for me was about getting to know the wonderful ensemble and pulling it out of them and being like, let's turn up the volume on your behavior. Let's, you know, be your full self. And then let me design that and stylize that so that you're constantly dancing through the whole show.
Kelly recently worked with actor Janelle McDermott on the show We're Gonna Die by Young Gene Lee. McDermott says she appreciates Kelly's collaborative approach.
Raja really encouraged finding what joy looked like for me. So there are a lot of moments in the show that were not necessarily pieces of choreography that Raja gave me, but moments he was like, yeah, dance, have fun. What do you want to do? I want people to see you. I want you to have fun. When you're not having fun, I can tell. And that doesn't work. And that's really incredible and such a huge gift and a challenge.
That's a theme in Kelly's work. He doesn't ask performers to make unusual shapes with their bodies or master intricate footwork. His choreography comes from his observations of people and how their movement can be used to tell a story.
So I worked with these people on just like, how do you look at the body in space? How does the body present, represent? So it's really a study in behavior. And that, for me, is very exciting.
Kelly's next project isn't a play, but a dance performance, re-examining the movie Dog Day Afternoon. He's going to tell it from the perspective of the trans character, who's hoping to undergo sex reassignment surgery. For NPR News, I'm Alexandra Starr in New York.
The same old story, lurching after glory.
I'm not going to stop asking until I get an answer, son.
And I fall short.
I want you to like my writing, my music, this show.
Blackness, queerness, fighting.
It's going to be nice to be able to go back and see shows again. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.